number one sports site in the world.
Live from the Quick and Loan studios of the Yahoo Sports Radio headquarters. Nighttime. This is the right time.
You know the nighttime now.
It's Tony D on Yahoo Sports Radio.
It's one of the reasons I still love sports, because you never know what you're going to get. In game two between the Oklahoma City Thunder and the San Antonio Spurs, my God, was that a wild 13 seconds or what? And the controversy of the Deion Waiters elbow to Manu Ginobili on the inbound pass. Spurs still get the basketball, and then all chaos ensued. But in the end, the Thunder hold on to a 98-97 victory, and they shake off the first game of this series and get the split that they want. This is why you don't overreact when teams get blown away in game one. Sometimes you just take your foot off the gas and you just figure out, let's just get the heck out of here and regroup. And the Thunder needed to play better defensively, and they did do that tonight. How about Steven Adams? He had 17 rebounds, 14 on the defensive side of the ball. They just played better defensively. They got a good, couple of blocks from Serge Ibaka tonight. They were looking for a better result from him. The Spurs didn't shoot all that well to start the game. And while this was a game of runs, the Thunder went up, and then the Spurs would catch up, and then the Thunder would extend a lead again, and the Spurs would catch up. This game is going to be remembered for what happened over the final seconds, as Manu Ginobili was guarding the inbound pass of Deion Waiters, and Waiters decided, that's enough of you being close to me, shoves an elbow at him, knocks Ginobili out of the play for a bit, enough to throw the inbound pass in, but the Spurs do get the ball. They steal it, they get it, and then sort of a rather chaotic offensive possession. Patty Mills is left open in a corner. Why he was taking the shot, I have no idea, but it ends up being pretty sloppy, and the Thunder hold on. Now, the instant reaction of people around the country and around the NBA circles were pretty outrageous, to say the least. This was a really bad call by the officials. Magic Johnson said it was the worst non-call in NBA playoff history. I mean, I don't know. I can't remember a list of all the non-calls off the top of my head. Maybe that's up there because it's the freshest one in our mind. I don't know how you miss this, though. That's the one thing. If you're a referee and you're watching, you've got to count to see him inbound the basketball. I don't understand how you don't throw it. You see a guy throw an elbow from the inbound. I just don't understand how you miss this. And I understand the philosophy. Look, refs want players to play, right? I mean, that's kind of what they want. But this was insane. I mean, Ginobili's trying to guard the inbound pass, and Waiters just sort of throws himself at him. I don't know if the NBA comes back, though, and says, because they've been doing this the whole playoffs, this shouldn't have counted, or this should have been called, or this should have been called. They're very quick to point out the mistakes the officials have made. I wonder if they're going to do that in this situation. Nevertheless, this series is now tied at one as they ship it back to Oklahoma City. And just to put in perspective what we saw tonight, the Thunder become only the second team in the NBA to beat San Antonio at home this season. And they get home court advantage in this series. Now, I don't know if that matters, because to some, it's a big deal to say that you've got the split you need and now you have home court. I think the Spurs are good enough to win anywhere. I don't know if the Spurs are incapable of winning in Oklahoma City to get it back. But now this series is interesting. Momentum is only as good until you start playing. Just like in baseball, momentum is only as good as the next day's starting pitcher. That's the way the NBA playoffs are. It is a game of space and time and adjustments. And when you have a game and then you have a day or so off before the next game and your teams are going to analyze tape on you, we're going to see different results. The Spurs did not shoot particularly well. Then they started shooting particularly well. And it was just one of those back and forth games. But the last 13 seconds was wild. Now, I will say this. I was talking to Adam about this before the show tonight. I blame Ginobili in a way. Manu Ginobili is one of the worst floppers in the NBA. If you get hit, and again, he tried to sell it a little bit by kind of flailing backwards, like, oh, what happened? But if I'm Ginobili in that situation and I need that call, I fake my death. Are you kidding? I fall on the ground. I lay still. I get paramedics out there. I get defibrillators out there. I have them called the stretcher. I mean, I make it absolutely clear that I got shoved. Ginobili's a master at this. I don't know why he wasn't a master. Like, if you're gonna go into the bag of flopping tricks, break out the worst flop you can imagine. I mean, seriously, sell it like you've never sold anything. Sell it like if you have to pay your rent with this deal. You got to go all out. Fall to the ground. You get shoved by Dion Waiters, man, you fake your death for crying out loud to get that whistle. But I think in the end, Ginobili was right in the post game afterwards. He said, look, we got the steal, and you know, we didn't get it done, and you know, time to move on. They did get the ball back, and I can't. The officials aren't really to blame for the rather sloppy offensive possession that San Antonio had on their final play. I mean, there was plenty of time to slow things down a little bit, but instead they were rushing around, looking for a shot. I mean, look, Mills is open, so get the ball to him and make him take the shot, but he's not the guy you want to shoot there. So overall, this was a rather interesting finish to a game the Thunder really had to have. We talked about this yesterday. A lot of speculation about where the Thunder would be in the offseason if they got blown out in this series by the Spurs. Now, a lot of talk about Kevin Durant. Would he realize that he couldn't win in Oklahoma City? Would he realize that once again his team is just a little short personnel-wise compared to the better teams in the Western Conference? Would he want to go somewhere else? Would he want to join Golden State to try to get that ring? Would he want to move into the Eastern Conference where he might be able to put a team together that could challenge LeBron to get to a finals and see what happens? A lot of speculation on that front. Now, that can calm down a little bit because the Thunder, again, get the split in San Antonio. 800-777-2907 is the number tonight. We got that for you, plus a lot of other things to get to, including a lot of reaction to the Luke Walton hiring. Some good, some bad. I thought it was a good hire by the Lakers. I thought he was the hottest name that you can get in the NBA. And if you're the Lakers, you get the hottest name you can get at this time. But the reaction to some people has been, oh, wait, this is a bad hire. The Lakers really needed to get a real entrenched professional, a guy who's been down this road before. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. We are going to get into some NASCAR tonight. Jordan Bianchi is going to join us from SB Nation to talk about the race Talladega. And I know we don't talk a lot of NASCAR on this show, but they had a crash fest at Talladega on Sunday. Crash fest. 35 cars were involved in some sort of accident. It's packed racing. It's restrictor plate racing. Drivers kind of voice their dissatisfaction with it. Cars got airborne. Danica Patrick said she was in one of the hardest crashes of her career. There's been a lot of now conversation about, is there anything that NASCAR can do? We'll talk to Jordan Bianchi again at the bottom of the hour. But we are going to get more into the playoffs. The Cleveland Cavaliers beat the Atlanta Hawks tonight, and they beat them by 11 as they hold Atlanta without a field goal for the final 3.5 minutes of the game. Cleveland has played 5 games in which they're 5-0, and this was, a by their own admission, an okay game. Atlanta, though, showed me something tonight. Now, listen, you go without a field goal for the final 3 minutes in 3.5 minutes of a game. I'm going to give credit to Cleveland, and I'm going to put blame on Atlanta. This isn't all Cleveland's defense, and it's not all Atlanta on poor shooting. It's a good combination of both, but I don't expect that. Atlanta came back in this game. Cavaliers were up by 18, and the Hawks came back and made that a game. I think Atlanta leaves this game a lot more confident than when they walked in. They feel like they're a better basketball team this year than the team that got blown out last year. Last year in the Eastern Conference Finals, Cleveland won all 4 games. LeBron James averaged like 30 points and 11 rebounds a game. And Atlanta feels like they're better now this year than last year. Now, tonight, there were flashes of that. And I've said this many, many times. I watch a lot of Atlanta basketball here in Nashville. They're not a really fun team to watch. They're not. If you're looking for the guy that pours in 35, they don't give you that. They've got a lot of good players that will get, 21 points and 13 rebounds or 17 points and 12 assists. They've got guys like that. But they don't have a star. They don't have a Russell Westbrook triple-double guy. They don't have a Kevin Durant 37-point guy. Right? They don't have that. But what they do is they balance. They have a balanced offensive attack, and they try to play. They play really good defense. They have like the second best defense in the league. But they have their hands full with LeBron. They don't have a guy that really can challenge LeBron. And when you add when Kyrie Irving plays well or Kevin Love plays well, this is a real defensive challenge for Atlanta. But I thought they showed some good stuff tonight. But they can get a split in this series and get back to Atlanta 1-1. But they're going to have to play better offensively in spurts, because trying to climb out of holes and then staying afloat, that was not their doing tonight. Coming up next, we'll talk a little bit more about what happened Sunday at Talladega and more of the thoughts of the playoff games that occurred on Monday night. It's Tony D on Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you
on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
All right, thanks for joining us on Yahoo Sports Radio. Again, 800-777-2907. If you want to get your thoughts in, if you saw the game tonight between the Spurs and the Thunder, I'm sorry, I'm going to go through this tonight, and I really don't mean to make light of it, because it's for you Spurs fans, it probably drives you crazy, but I retweeted Deadspin's video. They actually showed the video, kind of a close-up of Dion Waiters shoving Manu Ginobili out of the way. And as I look on my Twitter feed, all I see is that. And I got to be honest with you, it's hysterical. I mean, it is really hysterical. Ginobili is just all over Dion Waiters, just throwing his hands up and playing defense on the inbound pass, and he's getting close. And Waiters just goes, "Get out of here!" and just shoves him off to the side. It's hysterical. But the other part is this referee staring at them while he's making the count for the inbounds pass. And it's like the referee is just kind of looking, and you know how, I don't know, I got kids. Sometimes they talk to me and I'm thinking about something else. I'm like, "Oh, that's cute." And my son will be like, "Cute. I just told you and I'm like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I got to be honest with you. I wasn't really paying attention. I know I'm father of the year. Relax." But it feels like the official has just got like that deer in the headlights. Like, "I wonder if I can catch the plane out of here later tonight. I wonder if I should go eat at that really nice restaurant on my way out." And just completely oblivious to Manu Ginobili getting smacked as going backwards. But still, no matter how much they want to complain about that, and again, credit Manu Ginobili. He said, "Hey, at least we got the ball." They did get the ball, and they did get the ball. They just couldn't convert. Really sloppy. All right, we're going to talk about the NASCAR race at Talladega. Jordan Bianchi is going to join us to talk about the real. What I thought was a really bizarre race on Sunday. There were 35 cars that were involved in accidents. And every time we get these races at Talladega and Daytona, people argue about restrictor plates and the pack racing and whatnot. And look, I don't want drivers to die. I don't want drivers to get hurt, but you are what you are. I mean, you're getting behind the wheel of a car and you're trying to go close to 200 miles an hour, and accidents are going to happen. And cars are going to crash, and people are going to make mistakes. And when they make mistakes, things are just going to become like dominoes. And I don't know if there's an answer here, but Jordan Bianchi is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. But Steven from Ohio wants to talk about it. Steven, go ahead.
Hey, Tony. I'm glad I was able to get on before Jordan. I'm looking forward to his thoughts on this. But Talladega it's been this way since they started racing here, since they started putting the restrictor plates on. But yesterday, and you used, you called it, I think you said bizarre maybe, but it was a bizarre race. Because we saw something yesterday that we have not seen at Talladega. They're racing a different style. And Kyle Busch said it after the race, and it kind of got my attention. He said, "Why are we hitting? Why are we bumping now?" Because he said, "When you bump now, it actually slows the cars down. It's almost like you get up there, you hit that bottle of air, and then the second and third place car in line end up falling back, and there's nothing that you can do." NASCAR has put an aero package on these cars now that has made the style of racing at Talladega a lot like what it used to be and what the fans wanted. Problem is, that style of racing, these big packs and these big cushions of air that these cars are making now, and with the lower downforce that they have on them, it's almost impossible to keep them on the ground now. These cars are lighter. We heard drivers talking about that they were in the pack and the back end of the car felt a lot lighter. And when you see three cars in one race get upside down, that's a problem. And one of the things I pointed out to, and I've had a couple of discussions with people over the last 24 hours or so, that one of the things we did not see a lot of when cars got sideways yesterday were the roof flaps deploying. The two flaps on the top of the cars that are supposed to keep these things on the ground. When Chris Buescher got upside down, yes, it was a quick hit, but his roof flaps never deployed from the time that he turned sideways till he started barrel rolling down the backstretch. Kevin Harvick on the last lap, when he got turned, his roof flaps never deployed until after his crash was well underway, and it's supposed to be an instantaneous thing. So I think NASCAR has a situation in front of them that safety is becoming a major issue, and one of the things I think it's going to have an effect on is when we come back here in the fall, because Talladega is a chase race, and these drivers have now seen what kind of chaos this aero package can bring to these cars at this racetrack. And it's going to cause a major, major issue. And I think it's going to be an extremely disappointing race when we get back here. But safety has to be paramount, and this is something that I have to look at.
Are they going to be able to make a major engineering, you know, I don't want to say repairs, but modifications to cars before they go back in the fall?
We've seen it happen before. They've changed up the rear spoiler. They've put strips across the roof. Different types of things to change the way that these cars are handling in the draft. But with this aero package being what it is, I don't think that there's something that they can make a major change to before we get back there. Yes, the cars are going to change. We're going to get another generation of cars before we get back in the fall. But it's not going to be something that's going to make such a major, major impact. Paul Wolf, crew chief for Brad Keselowski, said after the race, he said, we're working on these roof flaps, and we're working on the safety initiatives. But we have a lot. We have a long way to go.
Wow! It's just, to me, I just don't listen. I understand. To me, it just doesn't look like there's an answer, because like you can't make the cars go 250 miles an hour because then they become like an airplane. But on the other hand, you can't make them go 150 miles an hour because, I don't know, people don't want that. But if I'm a driver, I want to race. I don't want to be in a rocket ship and trying to survive. I think that's my biggest complaint about this. And again, I'm just trying to simplify this for the average fan who watches this and goes, ugh, look, 30 cars are on top of each other. Yeah, that's really good. I mean, if you're watching this, people watch it for the crashes, but then there is a point where they go, yeah, but I don't want to watch 17 of them. I don't need to spend my whole day trying to see who's going to win this thing if all there are going to crash. If I get a driver like Kyle Busch saying he'd rather stay home than race this, then why are they racing this?
I don't know. Well, I think, I mean, it's something that comes down to the fact that they know they have to. But like you said, Kyle Busch said he would have rather stayed at home. But at the same point in time, I mean, Jeff Gordon said it yesterday in the booth. He said he hated this style of racing when he had to do it. But he enjoys watching it now, and I think that's the balance that we have.
That's a big statement, Steve. Not to interrupt you. That's a big statement, because you do not hear, and again, this is different because it's a life and death sport. I mean, I get it, you can die driving cars, and you can't playing baseball or football or anything else like that. But you don't hear people say, you know, like baseball analysts saying, oh, it's much better to be in the booth than be on the diamond, or I'd rather be up here in the booth than be on that football field throwing passes. Jeff Gordon was like, I'd rather be here than there. I don't want to be there. Now, he wouldn't say that at Bristol or Atlanta or some of the other places, but it seems like this race, drivers go, I get in and I get out, and I just want this thing to be done.
Yeah. And I mean, there's such a big difference, because we raced Daytona just, 12 weeks ago, and you didn't hear this type of thing. You didn't see the cars getting upside down. But here we are at Talladega and having the same discussion that we have every single year about what can we do about Talladega, and I'm not sure there is.
Thanks for the call, man. Appreciate it. Good insight. It's Steven in Ohio. Well, bringing him some NASCAR knowledge on the show. Jordan Bianchi again coming up in about 7 minutes. We'll get his thoughts on that. I mean, listen, when they first built those racetracks, I remember reading this great book. When I first started in radio, like they sent me to New Hampshire Speedway, and I didn't know anything about racing, so like I got suggested all these books to read and whatnot. And I was reading the history of the sport. When they first built Talladega, now granted, those guys weren't used to going that fast. There were drivers that came off that track going, I ain't doing that. I'm not used to going that. I'm not, you know, 200 something miles an hour. Again, when those cars were get sideways, they become like an airplane wing, and they were finding those boys out in the fields. That's a fast, fast racetrack, and it's just, Sunday was just not good. Jordan Bianchi joins us next from SB Nation on NASCAR, Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you
on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
Tony D here on the nighttime on Yahoo Sports Radio. Thanks for joining us. All right, you know, we've been talking a little NASCAR tonight as the Talladega race was little different with 35 cars, most of those involved in an accident and only 21 on the lead lap. Let's talk about NASCAR a little bit with Jordan Bianchi from SB Nation, especially this race at Talladega. How are you, Jordan?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on. It was a different race, that's for sure. A typical Talladega on a lot of levels, but a different Talladega as well.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of thinking at, because I want to say that it was unique, but it wasn't. It's not really, but in the end, how different was what we saw on Sunday?
Well, the end product really wasn't that different. We saw a lot of side-by-side racing, a lot of, you know, three-wide racing. We saw a lot of crashes, and we saw some cars get airborne, and that's kind of become the norm in restrictor plate racing at Daytona and Talladega over the years, especially in the last couple of years. We've seen a lot of cars take flight, and sometimes those cars have gotten in the catch fence. So yesterday was kind of a symbolic of the issues NASCAR has on restrictor plate racing, where the racing is really good, and fans love it because it is exciting, and it can be exciting at times, and it's dangerous, and fans like that element of danger. The problem is it seems like we're kind of getting up to that line, and we're getting to that point where you've got to be concerned that something bad is going to happen, and NASCAR has admittedly said they need to do a better job of making sure these cars stay on the ground, and they're working towards that, but it is a little... you really take a big step back when you see what happened yesterday when you had multiple cars get off the ground, and luckily everybody walked away and no one was injured, but it does make you pause.
Let's get the novice up to speed here. These are called restrictor plate races because they reduce the speed, therefore bunching the cars. Why, Jordan, do they do that?
Sure. Basically, it's a restrictor plate. What that does is it limits the airflow and gas into the engine, which then reduces the speed. And because they have the cars have restrictor plates on them, they basically create pack racing where you've got 20, 30 cars running around roughly the same speed in one large pack, and drivers can't separate. And the reason for that is because back in the late 80s, cars were getting so fast. They were running speeds at about 215, and they were going faster than some planes take off, and the cars just couldn't stick on the ground. They didn't have the aerodynamics. They're going too fast without the downforce to stay on the ground, and these cars were lifting off. And we saw cars fly into the grandstands almost on a couple occasions, and it just became a safety issue where NASCAR needed to do something, and the best thing to do, and it still is the best thing to do on some levels, is to apply these restrictor plates.
I heard Kyle Busch say, look, I'd rather stay home. Do a lot of drivers feel this way about these kind of races?
Absolutely. That's the predominant feeling among drivers. Some of them really, really like it. There are some drivers who really embrace restrictor plate racing. Dale Earnhardt Jr. is one of them. But when you see everything that happens in these races and the cars are lifting off the ground, and Kyle comes from an area where he was hurt last year at Daytona really badly. His career was almost ended when he hit a wall at about 100 miles an hour, and he broke his right leg and his left foot, and he didn't know if he was going to race again, and that happened because of this pack racing that we have. A lot of drivers feel that way. Like I said, some drivers love it, but the predominant feeling among these drivers is if they didn't have to do Talladega and Daytona every year, they would be very, very happy.
Was rain the potential of rain a factor in why guys were really all packed up in this race on Sunday?
I think on some level, yes, because the possibility that it was going to rain and the race was going to be shortened, and that was, you know, however they were running at that moment was going to be the finishing order, I think definitely factored into to some degree, and the intensity was definitely heightened. But, you know, ultimately the racing we saw for the most part was, you know, the kind of racing we see, you know, at every restrictor plate race, you know, four times a year. So maybe the intensity was up a little bit, but I don't think it produced any different kind of result that we've seen, you know, any other time. So, yes and no. I think it's something to look at.
Jordan Bianchi joins us, SB Nation, on NASCAR and the race at Talladega. And again, 35 cars were involved in some sort of accident in the field at the Geico 500. All right, so Jordan, if you have to have restrictor plates on these cars, as you said, they get so fast, so you have to do that. But it results in what we're seeing. Is there an answer to making these races more safe?
That's a great question, and that's something that NASCAR is trying to find out and try to determine. You know, you can't take the restrictor plates off these cars. You cannot do that. They simply would be too fast, and they would be lifting off the track on their own, and that is just not an option. And you're not going to, and maybe they should, but they're not going to. They could come in and they could rebuild Daytona and Talladega, basically lower the banking a little bit, make it more flatter. That would create some separation. But I don't think that's going to happen either. That would cost a lot of money. Fans love these races. So, you know, the answer to this question is probably somewhere in the engineering side of things, which is very complicated, and maybe there's an answer that NASCAR can figure out. But this is an issue that's been going on since 1987, and there really hasn't been a definitive way to, you know, prevent this from happening. So there's nothing on the horizon, and it's just something that you're going to have to almost accept, because there is not one change that makes sense, and everybody's going to agree upon. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just the kind of way it is right now.
I ask this next question knowing that, listen, I don't want to see a driver die, and I don't want to see a driver get hurt. But in a way, you are what you are. And when you get behind the wheel of a car and you go 200 miles an hour, it is what it is. Is there some sort of level of, hey, look, we're in the end, you're race car drivers, and this is what just is going to happen unless we slow you down to 150 miles an hour. But even then, there might be a problem.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I mean, you're a driver and you accept risk. You know, whether it's Daytona or Atlanta or Bristol, it doesn't matter. When you get behind the wheel, you accept the risk that, you know, something bad might happen to you, and that's part of it. But you kind of got to compartmentalize that a little bit. I will say this, though. The issue with cars and them getting airborne and stuff is also a risk for fans. We've seen it many times over the last few years where cars get airborne and the debris flies into the stands and fans have gotten hurt. We saw it last year at Daytona. We saw it in 2012 at Daytona. We've seen it at Talladega a couple times. A young woman broke her jaw in 2009 when Carl Edwards' car flew into the grandstand along the front stretch there. So it's more than just drivers, though, and you're running the risk of a fan getting seriously, seriously hurt or worse. I mean, you can't figure out a way to keep these cars on the ground. I understand the driver aspect. They basically sign up for this, so to speak. I don't know if you buy a ticket to a NASCAR race, you're going to want to accept the fact that you might have a car sitting in your lap.
Can there be any pressure from team owners? Because I saw the money figures for the cars that were out of the race, and I don't know if that's pennies or, you know, to these guys. I don't know if this was a real hit the wallet kind of thing, but it seemed staggering enough. Are the owners like, hey, listen, every time we come to these races, we're expecting to get our cars completely totaled?
Well, they do. I mean, they basically write it off, and they know that, you know, they are going to have, they're going to, you know, expense a car that they're not going to probably get to use more than a couple times because it's going to get destroyed. That's just the nature of the business, and it's part of racing, and it's Daytona and Talladega, and it's been that way for a long time. But the car owners and the drivers have a larger voice in NASCAR than ever before. The owners formed a coalition called the Race Team Alliance 2 years ago. They've been working very, very closely with NASCAR on some revolutionary measures to really give them a bigger voice and a bigger stake in how things are ran. It would not be... It would not be unexpected if they said to NASCAR, hey, we need to figure out something better here. And on that measure, the drivers now have a union, but not a union, but a coalition of drivers called the Sprint Cup Drivers Council that regularly meets with NASCAR on issues of competition and safety. And it wouldn't be surprising if the drivers came to NASCAR and said, hey, we need to do something here. NASCAR for a long time has been a sport that's been basically run by the France family, and it's been their vision and their goals and what they wanted to do was how this sport was ran. And the last 2 years, though, that has evolved for very much for the better on a lot of levels. And now that they're bringing in owners and they're bringing in these drivers and they're soliciting feedback and different ideas and working with them as partners, I think we're going to go down that road now where the drivers and the owners are going to kind of say, hey, you know, we need to really sit down and figure this out. And if this is something that we need to continue to do, or we need to make some adjustments.
Fascinating. Less than 60 seconds, I want to get this question. If there was a magic wand that eliminated these pack racing, would fans buy this?
I doubt it, because I think they like Daytona and Talladega for what it is, which is, you know, a white knuckle, three wide racing in the cars. And let's be honest, a lot of fans watch NASCAR because of the crashes. And if you take that away, I think you're going to lose some of that allure of what Daytona and Talladega represent.
Jordan Bianchi against SB Nation on NASCAR. Fascinating stuff. I really appreciate your time tonight, my friend.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
All right, coming up next, Magic Johnson has got some advice for his former team on how to get better now that they are under the tutelage of Luke Walton. But you know what? You can extend his advice to almost anything in life. I'll tell you how next. It's Tony D, Yahoo Sports Radio.
Tony D on the third shift.
It's Tony D with you
on Yahoo Sports Radio and yahoosportsradio.com.
Looks to get it in. Jump passes backcourt. Durant has it. Knocked down, no whistle. Green lobs to Mills. Right baseline, Ginobili. 6 seconds across the lane. Corner right, Mills. Rainbow three, no good. Rebound, Aldridge. Stripped on the floor. The Thunder win it.
As a Thunder Radio Network, the chaos in the final 13 seconds. That was a wild ending to that game. That was really, like, part of me thought it was really fun, and there's another part that went, what did I just watch? What did I just see? It's like watching, sometimes in these games, it's like watching like youth basketball, where everybody just kind of, oh, it's a mess! Nobody knows where the ball is! Ah! It's just like that. And you know, it's the Thunder had their shot. Yes, Ginobili should have sold getting hit by Waiters better. Maybe they would have actually called it if Ginobili, like, flopped to the ground and pretended he was dead. But you know what? It really didn't matter because they got the ball and they had chances. They just didn't, they just didn't set up. I mean, again, hindsight's 20/20, but that's what we do here. It just felt like there was too much time to be that chaotic.
You know what else was actually missed on the actual inbound pass?
Was Ginobili stepping on the line?
No, it was the fact that Waiters left his feet to throw the ball. You cannot do that.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Yeah, I saw one person on Twitter mention that.
Yeah, I saw Chris Mannix talking about it, and I just kept overlooking it because I know that's a rule. You can't leave your feet. You can't make it better for yourself. So
God, that official is blind as a bat.
And it's clearly the video you watch, he's staring right at him.
I cannot stop watching this video. It is like watching the Zapruder film. I can't stop watching it. There's an official staring at Deion Waiters, staring at him this whole time, and he leaves his feet and pretty much punches Manu Ginobili in the face.
Yeah, it's not like Manu's up chest to chest with him.
Right.
Manu's a good, like, 2 to 3 feet away from him. And he reaches forward, hits him with an elbow, and then jumps up and does a jump pass, which he cannot do either.
So he leans in and goes, bam! And then jumps up and throws the ball.
And still makes a terrible pass.
And the referee is just like, what do you want from me?
I see nothing.
What are you talking about? What truck?
And for people saying that, you know, Ginobili stepped on the line, that happens all the time.
That happens all the time.
Any inbound play in NBA history that somebody's guarding the ball, they always step on the line.
But
always.
That infraction doesn't allow you to do
those things
that Waiters did. Like, that's the point. Like, people saying, well, he stepped on the line, but that doesn't make it a free-for-all where you can pretty much,
let's elbow him in the face.
You can elbow him in the face and then jump, throw the ball. That's crazy.
That's just ignorance.
Now I've been scrambling, and this was over like within a couple minutes before we were starting to really get ready to go on the air.
Right.
Now I'm seeing on Twitter that a fan had grabbed Steven Adams' jersey.
Saw something like
at the
that
end
as
of
well.
The game, or somebody grabbed somebody.
It was Steven Adams.
A fan had grabbed him, and so I'm like, what is this?
Yeah.
Now, whenever you go to a game, like if you go to like an NFL game, I used to cover the Broncos, and this happened all the time, where there would be a reporter that was assigned to the officials, so that you don't get the officials mobbed by every reporter that wants to know why a pass interference was called late or whether or not they saw a touchdown score or something along those lines. So you assign one reporter from the pool and then they go get those quotes. And I'm waiting to see if that's going to come out. Like, who went to the officials in this game to talk to the officials to get their take on how in the world they missed this final call?
Okay, so
which is still hilarious.
I don't know. Have you seen the pictures of Steven Adams being grabbed?
No, I have not seen the pictures of Steven Adams being grabbed. The only thing I know about it is that I saw a couple of people on Twitter mention it about how he got grabbed towards the end of the game.
I'll retweet this at Adam G. Sager, but what it is, he must have been the one to try and block Petty Mills' shot in the corner.
And he then, got, oh, geez, really?
Yeah, so it looks like a female fan reaches up and grabs his arm.
Brilliant.
With 2.2 seconds left, and then it has kind of a frame by frame next to each other. 1.8, you see him like yanking his arm away to run back towards the basket.
I'm surprised we don't have a dancing elephant coming out on the court to perform, you know, a little bit of Shakespeare or something. Yes. I mean, this had everything.
I just retweeted it.
this had everything tonight, these final 13 seconds. So Patty Mills, and by the way, can we just say what it was? Patty Mills shot the worst three-pointer I've ever seen in that situation. I mean, my kid could have at least hit the rim on that. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible shot. It was so bad that you could tell immediately it wasn't going in.
Yes.
As soon as he released the ball, you knew that had no chance of being knocked down. It was that
and
awful.
It wasn't like he was trying to rush it, you know, a last quick second right at the buzzer. There was, obviously by the Steven Adams pictures, there was at least 2.5 seconds left when he shot the ball, so he didn't need to rush it. You take your time, you set, and you shoot a ball, and he didn't come close.
Yeah, oh my God.
But the other thing I thought was Ginobili, you know, you think he made the mistake of not flopping harder. All he had to do was lay the ball in. Instead, he like throws it over his head back to Patty Mills.
That's another thing. I mean, it was for all that, listen, you can, and again, the call should have totally been made.
Yes.
The official totally botched it. But San Antonio, that was as bad of an offensive series and it wasn't like they got the ball with 3 seconds left and had to panic. There was enough time to do something. I think in that situation, you have the advantage. You have the advantage personnel-wise.
Real quick, NBA crew chief Ken Maurer met with the media. He said, on the floor, we did not see a foul. However, upon review, it was definitely should have been an offensive foul.
Yes, it should have been. We didn't see it because we were thinking about other things while
should've
we were staring
ball,
right at
it.
All right, coming up next hour, Luke Walton. The right hire? We'll talk about it next.